Hello everyone and welcome to the Middle East and North Africa Social Policy Network podcast series. We hope you enjoy this episode. Make sure to subscribe to our channel and follow us on social media. For more information, please visit our website at www.menasp.com.
Hello and welcome to our roundtable on gender-sensitive social protection as part of the MENA Social Policy Network Early Career Researcher Initiative. My name is Tamara Cole, and together with Dr. Noor Alabbas, we are the representatives of the Early Career Research Initiative. This will be our last session before we hand over to the new representatives. For today's session, we will be joined by Dr. Mariam Ebrahimi, who holds a PhD in social welfare from Alameh Tabatabai University in Tehran, Iran. Her doctoral research focused on gender analysis of social protection in Iran and analyzes gender orientations of employment, education, and social security legislation. In addition, she has undertaken a number of research projects and has presented several papers on women, family and gender issues. She also contributed a chapter on gender analysis of social protection in Iran to the Handbook of Social Protection Systems, which is open access available. In addition, we are pleased to welcome Dr. Hania Shokami, who is an anthropologist and holds a PhD from LSE. Her work has focused on gender, health and social protection in Egypt. She designed and piloted the cash transfer programs of the government of Egypt in her capacity as special advisor to the Minister of Social Solidarity. In addition, she is a proponent of feminist social protection and has lobbied for the rights of women to receive welfare and pension in their own right and not as dependents. Following a short introduction by Dr. Rana Jawad, the founder of the MENA Social Policy Network, each speaker will present her work for the next 15 minutes. Now, without further ado, I would like to give the floor to Dr. Rana Jawad for a few introductory words on the network and on the topic. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. Thank you very much, Tamara. It's really a very brief introduction for me because I think it's just great that we're able to gather everyone in this meeting. And thank you all for your interest and your support, whether you're presenting or joining us for the first time or you join us regularly. I think we're very fortunate to have our very distinguished speakers, Dr. Mariam, who I've never met before. So it's very great that you're interested to be involved. And thank you, as always, Dr. Hania, for being a longtime supporter of the group. I think this is really just to say that it's great that we're able to have this space and discuss social policy issues in the Middle East and North Africa region, away perhaps from the more standardized focus around international security issues. Though, of course, we know that social policy is very important, both as a driver of questions of conflict and peace, but equally important in its own right for the expansion of social rights, and certainly the issue that we're looking at today around issues of gender empowerment. And it's great to have an Iranian perspective in the network as well. So just to thank everyone, and I hope you continue to support us and be active with us, and eventually everyone gets to speak as well. It's great to do these talks online as well. I think in a sad way, COVID has opened up opportunities for us. And I think most importantly, we really need to thank our early career representatives, Tamara and Noor, who've just done amazing work in extending the breadth of reach that we've got. So thank you again, and I look forward very much to the talks.
Great, thank you so much, Dr. Rana. And herewith, I would like to open or ask Dr. Mariam to please share your thoughts and your research. I will start the slides. Just one moment, please.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Tamara, dear Tamara. As Tamara introduced me, my name is Mariam Ebrahimi. I'm from Iran, and I have a PhD in social welfare, and my areas of research is are gender policies and social security policies, education and employment policies. And I have some article and project about these topics. Thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this webinar. And my favorite subject, gender sensitive social protection schemes. As a mother, I went through a lot of hardship during motherhood because of the lack of social protection schemes in Iran. So this is my favorite topic, and I like working on this topic during my life. In Iran, but gender policy making is a bit complicated. So I have to explain about some topics. Next slide, please. Thank you. I have to explain about these topics in education, employment, social protection scheme, and gender discourses. In introduction, I would like to talk about the status of women, education and employment, and the attitudes about women education and employment, and being in the public sphere to show what women do in their real lives. After that, I will talk about different social protection schemes to show you what kind of schemes policymakers consider for women, and after that, about different policymakers institutions and their gender discourses. Finally, we will find the answer of the main question: to what extent social protection schemes are cognizant of the life experience of individual. Next slide, thank you. At first, about education. The school system in Pahlavi era was kind of secular system, and many religious and traditional families did not attend a school. But after Islamic Revolution, girls and women in public education increased. But about university, however, in universities, because of gender segmentations of job, we had some restrictions on entering some majors and disciplines in the first decade of the Islamic Revolution. As you see in this slide, it has changed, and now about half of the university students are women, and in all majors, even those had considered for men. You can see the percent of women involved in universities during after Islamic Revolution, and now approximately half of women of university students are women. Next slide. Thank you. And they are in different majors, in medical science, basic science, engineering, that had considered for men in the first decade of the Islamic Revolution. But although the role of motherhood and caring was heavily emphasized by the revolutionary regime, education was also necessary in order to raise better children in policy makers' thought. This increase of women in higher education provides an effective and new lens for viewing the role of women and their different roles, especially in the public sphere. But although women make up an increasingly large share of university graduates, they are in a minority in the employment population. You can see the employment rate in this in the next slide. Thank you. And you can see the gender gap between men and women during after Islamic Revolution. Labor participation rate is. This means that although women continue to perform well academically, they are consistently underrepresented in the formal labor market. Another point is that research and surveys show Iranian agreement with women's vote, but the gender gap is but the gender gap in formal employment is high, 69% for men and just 13% for women. So most of women, do not benefit from social protection schemes and formal employment. Another point is that due to liberalization and global economy, informal employment has increased in Iran. And this kind of employment with no contract do not benefit from social protection schemes. And because of women roles at home, caring roles, and different roles they have during their lives, they have to be in part-time job and temporary contracts. I work 7 years with no contract and no social protection schemes. So neither permanent contracts nor social protection schemes for women. Next slide, please. Come on. Yeah, thank you. Another important subject is kinds of social protection schemes. We have some of them in our labor law and other women's law, consisting of maternity leave, part-time job for mothers, less work hours for mothers who have under 6 years old children, teleworking, especially during COVID-19 era, survivors benefits, generous survivors benefits, and social assistance schemes for female-headed households, like cash transfers, in-kind transfers, and some allowances. As you see, these schemes include some motherhood risk and just for formal employment, who are in formal employment. But social protection measures need to be designed to respond to different gender categories of risks, including health risk, life cycle risk, childbearing, divorce, widowhood, and exclusion, special exclusion in Iran with a traditional family, domestic violence, and etc. Even researchers show that being a woman in Iran, one is more likely to fall into poverty trap. It has been found that 40% of all female-headed households fall into the two lowest economic decile, while it's 16, just 16% for male-headed households. So our social protection scheme are cognizant of some life experience of individuals, but not many of them. And these are just for those who are in formal employment. And so most of women do not benefit from these schemes. Another important, next slide. Thank you, Tamar. Thank you. Another important point is that we have, after Islamic Revolution, we have a lot of policymakers, a lot of policymaking institutions, for example, governments, Islamic Consultative Assembly, the Supreme Council of Cultural Revolution, and Experience the Discernment Council. And all of them participate in the gender policy making. And the dominant and the dominant gender approach of these institutions as men as breadwinner and women as homemaker, like one is in a traditional and religious families. I mean, this model of family is an ideal type of family in this institution that affects social protection schemes. Policymakers just consider just three categories of women. The first group, which comprises a small proportion of women's population, as in formal employment that's supported by social security system and labor law. The second category of women are housewives who are supported by an insured man, and more than half of women in Iran are in this category. They indirectly benefit from some social insurance, as men are the head of family in a traditional and religious culture, and in our civil law, they are responsible for providing family expenses. The third category of women are the head of household women. This group is more vulnerable and face higher risk of poverty. These women, just poor ones, benefits from some restricted social assistance programs. In conclusion, as I said, there are different gender approaches in our society, but policymakers consider one gender approach. Some families protect their girls, and some women like being just a homemaker, but not all of them, especially educated women. So we need more social protection schemes for different roles, different women's risk. The next point is that in a global economy and new risk, most of women need a job, especially in Iran, because of high expenses, especially that we suffer from many sanctions and high inflation rates. So most of the women need jobs, and they work in informal employment. I said that no, neither social protection scheme, no contract. The last point is that I think policymakers should pay more attention to different rules and different risks that women face in global economy, and especially pay more attention to cultural changes in the globalization era. Their roles, their women roles at home, at work, especially they must pay more attention, enough attention to men as spouse, fathers, not just consider them as a breadwinner. Nowadays, father have less opportunity to play the paternal and spousal role due to an overwhelming presence in the public as well. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Dr. Maryam Ebrahimi, for this wonderful introduction and also reflection on the different roles of women, but also how that permeates in not just society and the household, but it also goes into the institution and is linked to the larger economy. And I think these are very worthwhile considerations because this also makes it such a complex issue. I would like to give the floor to Dr. Hania Shokami to discuss her own work.
Thank you, Tamara, and thank you, Rana, and for the invitation. And I enjoyed very much Dr. Maryam's presentation. I'm talking today about a work that actually I'm doing with Dr. Naila Kabir, who is attending the seminar. Hello, Naila. And also with other colleagues from Dr. Hudal Baby, who is with us, who was with IFPRI, who is familiar with this work. So what is this work about? So this presentation, which I promise will not take as long as it could, is about the gender implications of cash transfers looking at impact in Egypt. And it's specifically a presentation about how we measure gender impact. The problem is that we overpromise when we are trying to convince policymakers and donors and so on to initiate gendered social protection programs. And social protection programs in general, and cash transfers in particular, have promised inclusion. They've promised some kind of sustainable livelihood, good governance, participation, empowerment, and even poverty alleviation. And they can't do that, because we are talking about people who are in structural positions of inequality and poverty. And I think the main distinction I would like to make is between program design that can incorporate gender, but that doesn't mean that it can change or lift conditions of inequality. I'm talking specifically about the Karama and Takaful program in Egypt. And Karama and Takaful is a well regarded cash transfer program in Egypt that was introduced in 2014-2015. And an IFPRI evaluation has showed that it has increased household consumption by over 8%. It has reduced the probability of beneficiaries falling below the poverty line. But even this national initial baseline evaluation confirmed that cash transfers have not been sufficient to provide a large investment needed to get out of poverty. So they are programs that have been successful in terms of what cash transfers can do, but they have their limitations. And one of these limitations was the impact on women's empowerment and gender roles. Now, this IFPRI evaluation, the baseline, used decision-making variables to approximate empowerment. And our research questions the veracity and appropriateness of decision-making as a proxy for changed gender dynamics. In this research, we used a multidisciplinary approach, not to prove or show gender impact, but to find the right questions and methodologies that are meaningful and that can approximate social change. So this, we basically what we did for the purpose of this study was that we added the gender module to the 2021 impact evaluation questionnaire of IFPRI, which has just come out. And the results have just come out. And it was administered to a subset of that same national data collection. Of course, a smaller number. But what we did was use the same, the data was carried out, collected at the same time as IFPRI. It used it added just a different gender module, but used the same sampling frameworks and so on. The limitations are, of course, that we are talking about a smaller sample of women. Another limitation, which is a limitation in our data collection, and I dare say in the IFPRI one as well, which is the larger sample, is this definition of the categories of non-beneficiary and beneficiary. Who is considered a beneficiary of the cash transfer programs and who is not simply a category that is can be taken as a snapshot. It's unclear because some people were on the benefits and were taken off. Some people are receiving the benefits, but not reliably so that there's been a delay in getting the benefits on a monthly basis. Some people are expecting to be on the benefits. There are mixed households where there are multiple families living together with some taking, some not taking. So this is a major, I think, limitation when we try to set up this modeling of gender impact when we contrast or compare beneficiaries with non-beneficiaries. And another limitation is this, the problem of measurement itself, where there are the opposing opposing trends of, on the one hand, trying to find indicators or questions that are relevant and specific, and on the other hand, wanting to speak to a literature, an international literature or an academic literature, and therefore trying to find indicators that are comparable and measurable. So, and because it's just 15 minutes, I'm not going to go very deeply into any of these issues right now. So what is the problem with decision-making? Why were we critical of this notion of using decision-making as a proxy for gender empowerment or gender change? It measures, so what is decision-making is supposed to, or participation in decision-making is supposed to be proxies for a sense of autonomy, an autonomous agent, a sense of control over money, and a sense of equality between men and women. And the literature is plentiful on these intra-household bargaining models and what they're supposed to mean and how we measure them. And it usually, ultimately, the question is who in your household usually has the final say in a given domain, and the domain is often health, education, expenditures, going even to who decides what food is being cooked. So the limitations of these models of intra-household bargaining and decision-making is there are, you know, four main limitations, I think, also expressed in the literature, on the critical literature on this. The first is this notion of jointness in decision-making. That assumption that an autonomous decision is better than a joint one or a negotiated one. The second is the threat points and false power dynamics, that ultimately what you're trying to understand is the end of a process, that the actual decision made, and not the process by which the decision comes up. And a third is about household, this notion of households as organized consumption and production units with clear divisions of labor, which really sometimes ignores the context in which these households exist. And the fourth, and maybe the most interesting one for me personally, are the perceptions of social desirability. that the assumption is that autonomy is socially desirable and control is socially desirable, that these are the values that women aspire to, and that ignore what has been called in the literature the respectability premium, the notion that conservatism, conformity, and so on is a domain of privileged social groups, and that there might be aspirations to realize these social norms. The first three limitations are amenable to measurement, but I think the fourth requires a different methodological approach to measuring gender impact. So I think this decision making and social cash transfers in particular, there's qualitative evidence points to that the impact of cash on decision making is mixed. There is evidence also available about the unreliability of the existing literature because of what has been called a publication bias, whereby non-impact results do not get published. And a growing number of unpublished manuscripts are demonstrating the need for a more careful examination of the effects of gender and social protection. So in our research, we found that there are several missing dimensions to the empowerment model that informs these measurements, relational aspects of agency. And I've just listed some quotes from women, I won't read them out, that make the point. So the relational aspect of agency, issues about well-being and health, issues about worry and insecurity and mental health, as I said, the autonomous agent that is free to conform or resist, the ability to support other people. So taking women out of the household and into communities to see how this form of support can enable an agency, a social agency or a community agency, and questions about household acrimony and gender-based violence. I'm just going to show you some results for time. I know I've got only a few minutes left. So these are some of the results from the data that we've collected, and I've just written in red what I'd like to draw your attention to. Although decisions are jointly made, whether in households that are benefiting, 86%, or in households that are not benefiting, we noted something that is interesting for us, and that is that 16% of beneficiaries are able to lend money to their husbands regularly, against only 2% of their counterparts. So we heard a message about maybe not controlling decisions, but being able to make decisions that were not on the table, such as lending the husband. Just over half of beneficiaries say they control the money they get from the transfer, and the rest do so jointly with their husband. But the most interesting finding in terms of income and control is about credit worthiness. Now, we know that indebtedness and poverty go hand in hand, and 93% of those who valued being able to take a major loan said that they were able to do so after receiving the transfer, against 44% of the treatment group. So the cash transfers have enabled a kind of predictability of income that has added to women's creditworthiness vis-a-vis other women who are not beneficiaries. I think the peace of mind findings are important. 97% of beneficiaries said that they had peace of mind and better sleep. We asked specifically questions about sleep. Three quarters feel that they can now even spend on non-essentials, something that is valuable to women themselves, like buying fino bread or better bread. And almost half were able to pay off major debt at least once, against only a third of non-beneficiaries. In terms of relationships, I don't want to read all of this out, but 95% of beneficiaries acknowledge that their relationship in the household has improved. 3/4 of women find that receiving the cash transfers have made their relationship with their husband more secure, 2.5 less so, and 68% feel that they are now better wives. 66% of women used to feel fear that no one would help their family in case of need because they could not afford to carry out social visits or give gifts to people. After receiving the transfer, however, over 3/4 of women claim to now have become a source of support for their family and neighbors, and 36% say it has made them more generous with others. This aspect of gift giving, relationships within the community, not within the household, is often overlooked as an aspect of gender ability of, or social change. I think my last slide is about mothering. How the transfers have changed the relationships between mothers and their children, that they now as women feel that they are relied upon, and 95% feel no, that said that their children no longer ask for their husbands for anything, small expenditures. And most feel that the husband has become happy because the transfer has helped with household expenses. I think the takeaways from this different approach to measurement are the following: that changing power dynamics take more than cash. So if we want to lift patriarchy, we really need more than cash increments to people's incomes. That limiting gender change to households ignores relational aspects of women's social agency. That models of empowerment need context and an arc of change. They should also be mindful of context and of multiple worlds inhabited by women. Peace of mind, respect in the home and community, control over relations, and the ability to give are valued by women, maybe more than taking part in decisions. And finally, that social transfers enable women to adapt, not to change, burdens of poverty. Therefore, research on gender and social protection should adopt tools capable of capturing these small acts of change. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for your presentation and for staying within the time limit. It's quite dense, a lot of information to take away, but it's also very interesting because you can see also the overlap emerging to an extent with what Dr. Maryam Ebrahima was already referring to. And I would like to thank all of you for staying with us for so long. I think we have had a very interesting discussion with a lot of food for thought, and I think there's still a lot of discussion to be had. So I look forward to any forthcoming research. I would like to herewith thank the speakers again, Dr. Maryam Ebrahimi and Dr. Hania Shokami for joining us from Beirut and from Iran. And I wish you all a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you very much for everyone. Thank you, Rana.
Thank you all. So nice to see you all. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's continue the discussions.